Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
Their regulations announced a week ago do not have, even theoretically, the possibility of restoring integrity. Looks like the regulations were made to fit the shoe. You must be 5% better than everyone else, or you have to have the shoe.
Athletes can't really speak out about this. Scientifically speaking, it doesn't make sense to be racing in anything else.
So welcome to the Science of Sport, our second season of the Science of Sport. And for those of you that joined us in 2019, really appreciative of all the comments we've had over the last 6 months, and in particular over the time that we've been off air for a while. And I do apologize for that. I know we've been taking a bit of a hiatus from January. I think late December, our last podcast of 2019. But I've been a little bit busy at the beginning of the year, and I know Ross has been chomping at the bit to try and get the podcast underway for 2020. So a lot to look forward to in 2020, of course, because we've also got the Olympic Games happening on a bit later on this year, and there's the T20 cricket happening, and of course it is the start of a decade, which means always things happen at the start of a decade. And talking of things that happen, I'm sure that all of you that have clicked on the link to this podcast would have read that we are doing the Shoe That Broke Running episode number 2. And we are just a few days away from the announcement of Nike's new Alphafly, is it? The Alphafly Next Percent?
Yeah.
Which is the next iteration of the initial Nike Vaporfly. And it is causing ructions around the world of athletics. It's causing massive discussion on all the websites around the world, and it is massively controversial. And we're going to talk about that today. And I think what we're going to do is take you through a little bit of the history of this shoe, why it has affected the sport so much, and then get into some of the nuts and bolts about why we're talking about what has happened in the last week around this particular shoe, because it is fascinating and it is something that is quite worrying for the world of sport and the world of athletics in particular. So Ross, just kind of give us a bit of a précis as to the history of the Vaporfly, the Nike Vaporfly. When did this all start, and kind of where have we got to now quickly?
Apparently it started in 2013. I was reading something the other day in which they described the beginnings of the work on this new shoe at that point. It was in 2016 that it became spoken of, because that's when it was first used in competitions. It was the shoe that was promoted in conjunction with the first sub-2 marathon attempt. That was the one that was done in Monza, you'll recall, where Kipchoge plus Tedesi, plus the third person whose name I've now forgot, Lalisa, tried to break two. Kipchoge got really close, and the shoe was one of the elements of that. So at that time, I'll be honest, as a scientist, it looked like marketing.
Yeah.
Because as you know,
as a journalist, I can agree that it looked like marketing as a journalist.
Yeah, you're not just a journalist, like the editor of Runner's World. So like this is, you see probably 100 of these things a year, right?
Yeah.
Every shoe company claims XYZ, whether it's injury or performance. And most of the time you just say, oh, whatever, it's marketing speak, put it out there and let the world sort of forget about it within 2 weeks. This one wasn't forgettable because it seemed there was something to it. And, you know, when it came out, I remember they named it the Vaporfly 4%. And there was talk that the 4% came from some studies where they'd found that there was a 4% reduction in the oxygen cost of running. So your economy improved by 4%. And that's a big number because the day-to-day variation is around 1%. So when you start saying we're going to make you 4% more efficient, that's massive. I mean, 4% efficiency is the equivalent of having about 400 grams less on your feet.
Yeah.
So just to conceptualize what that means. So at that point, I was like, I wonder if there's something to this, you know? And then because the sub-2 in Monza was
so confounded by the car, the drafters, the course, the fluids and the fuels and all the stuff, it was quite difficult to assess the shoe independent of all the other things. But over the course of the next few months, it started to emerge that maybe the shoe was doing something meaningful, substantial.
Yeah.
And then we discovered that it had been used in the US trials. It had been used by all three medalists in the Olympic Games marathon in 2016 in Rio. And people started to talk. And by 2018, it was winning almost all the races. In 2019, in the build-up to London, they announced version 2, which was called the Next Percent. And it was named Next because their internal studies had shown that it was better than the 4%. So now we're talking, what, 5, 6%? No one was saying anymore because I think the shutters had gone down. They didn't want anymore to have this conversation out there because I think they realized that it was causing controversy in the sport. Because bottom line is this, if you get 3 to 4% economy, that's worth 1 to 2% performance. And that is decisive. You're winning a marathon against an athlete who physiologically is superior to you if you get a 2 to 2.5% performance boost.
Right.
And so all of a sudden people were saying, is this fair? And I think the answer is clearly no. But that brings us to where we are today. So 2019 was the year of the Next Percent. 86% of the podium spots in the major marathons were filled by Next Percent. 86% of the winners wore that shoe.
Yeah.
In the most remarkable one of all was in a recent Ekiden relay in Japan. Almost everyone wore it, and there were guys coming fifth who broke the previous record that had stood for a decade.
Yeah.
And so it was clearly transformational. This was not so much evolution of footwear. It was a revolution. And pressure was mounting to do something. And so they did not, I guess. And that's why it's an issue now. So now we see version 3.0, which is actually 3.1, because when Kipchoge did eventually break the two-hour marathon last year in October, he wore version 3, which was called the Alpha Fly.
Yeah.
And then these new regulations have set a limit on stack height, and we'll get into the nuts and bolts of this, at 40 millimeters, which made, I think, that shoe illegal. But Nike have just come out with an Alpha Fly Next Percent, which is legal within 4 days, mind you, of the policy coming out. And so here we are. And the point is, their regulations announced a week ago do not have, even theoretically, the possibility of restoring integrity. They look enormously uncertain. They look manipulated. I mean, I'll say from my perspective, it looks like the regulations were made to fit the shoe as opposed to the other way around. Mm. And I don't think that the sport is going to get any healthier as a result of these regs.
I want to stop you there briefly because I just want to take a small step back. And I think there's a lot of people who get involved in this debate, particularly on Twitter. I know you've got a big audience on Twitter and there's a lot of debates around this particular subject. But let's just clarify. When we talk about the integrity of the sport based on this mechanical doping, is what people are calling it. Let's take, for instance, Adidas's Boost technology, which they had. So they produced a shoe which gave some sort of energy return, and there must have been some sort of benefit for the runner that was running it. Otherwise, you know, the people wouldn't have wore it, and it's done well as a brand. What's the difference between Adidas's Boost technology and the technology in this Nike shoe, and where do we draw the line as to how much performance benefit is there mechanically?
Yeah, so this has come up many times. That particular shoe, I've seen one study looking at, and it had, if I recall correctly, 10 or 11 guys, and they found that the running economy was improved by 1%. Now, 1% is 0% because the day-to-day variation in economy is more than 1%. So if you were to go out and run at exactly the same speed and exactly the same conditions with exactly the same shoes on 5 consecutive days, there would be a day-to-day up or down of more than 1%. So it's not real until it exceeds that variation.
But 1% compared to what? Compared to barefoot or other competitors? Or
in that particular study, I think they used it because, remember, their premise was that this Boost cushioning returned more energy. So they would have compared it to the energy, the material in a midsole before Boost, which was EVA.
Right.
And one of the things, in fact, about this Nike shoe is the midsole foam is called PBAX, or they've given it their own Nike name.
But it is lighter and
Zoom Plus, isn't it?
Zoom X, I think.
Yeah, Zoom X, I think.
And that shoe's been shown to return more energy even than the Boost. So this happens. I mean, so innovation is normal.
Yeah.
But the difference between now and then is the scale. And the difference in scale means that it's not real when it was only 1%. This is a real significant difference.
Well, it was interesting that in 2016, Kara Goucher came out and she was kind of the person, I wouldn't say blew the whistle, because we're not necessarily in that Nike did anything deliberately wrong here. But she said there's the shoe coming out, which is going to make a significant difference, and drew the IAAF at the time, World Athletics now, to the possibility that they might need to do something. So they were warned about the shoe, you know, 4 years ago. You know, it's been a long time.
Yeah, so the best case you can state from the perspective of World Athletics is that they sat on this issue for 4 years before they decided to act. And by the time they then acted, it was in their minds too late to put the toothpaste back in the tube. And Co, in a statement that I've no doubt was written by a press PR person, basically said, we're not here to regulate the market and what's already on it. Well, the only reason the shoe, as of the 6th of February, is out there as it is because you didn't regulate it from 2016. And the story there was that Goucher trained with an athlete called Shalaya Kipp, who is also a PhD in exercise science, and she was involved in the testing of the Vaporfly. So Nike shipped, obviously Nike would have done their own testing, but then they sent the shoe to a lab that they obviously fund people in Colorado, and the shoe arrives and they started calling it the Magic because they recognized, I guess, straight away that this was different from anything that had been presented before in scale and concept. And so Kip told Goucher, and in response, Goucher then queried it and was told to submit an official, I don't know if it's a complaint or objection or what you want to call it. But she did, but of course nothing happens. And so I think it's clear that the authorities knew it at that point already, but didn't do anything. And so then this thing starts to gain momentum, and eventually it's been used so often that it's now the shoe that's broken the women's world record, men's records at 10 and 21, and in fact the marathon, if you think the Vaporfly 4% that Kipchoge wore, various city marathon records, Olympic medals and so on. And they are, in a sense, victims of their own inactivity.
Yeah.
And and that's why when we did the podcast last year in October, and go back and listen to it if you missed out on it, you called it the shoe that broke running. I think the authorities had the opportunity a week ago to fix what had been broken. I mean, you'll never repair what's gone in the past, but they had the chance and they didn't take it because, and I joked, I said it's the emperor's clothes of regulation, because the two things they did broadly were they reminded themselves of their own rule around prototypes.
Yeah.
And secondly,
let's just go back to that. So the original rule on the IAAF constitution or whatever it was, that is that a shoe can't give an unfair advantage. That's kind of the
sort of. I mean, it was worded in a way that was meant to be more specific than that, but wasn't. And this goes back now. We can go back a decade more. 2008, Oscar Pistorius is trying to run at the Able-Bodied Olympics, and the IAAF says no because your blades give you an advantage. And he says no, they don't. And it becomes a court case at CAS, which really was the precursor.
You were very
to this.
Vocal on that particular subject.
Yeah, because it was so clear to me then that the carbon fiber was beneficial for running. And I think that the line between where we are today is a straight one back to that. I'm pretty sure that people were looking at that and saying, you know, this carbon fiber thing, we need to explore this. Because let's not forget, shoe companies had tried carbon fiber before, but they didn't have the capacity to curve the plate. And if you look at Oscar Pistorius or any one of those double amputees or single, you'll see the curvature of that carbon fiber blade. That's what it required. And Nike managed to do it for technical reasons we'll get into. But anyway, the IAAF then creates a single point in their regulations that says that athletes may not wear devices that provide unfair assistance. Pistorius says, no, you can't add that in just for me. And the court agreed with him. So in the court of arbitration decision, which eventually sided with Pistorius, they rebuked the IAAF for that policy. In response, that policy disappeared.
Yeah.
And so at the conclusion of the Pistorius case, regulation around shoes was zero. There was not one thing in there about it. And so there was this vacuum, which I think Nike then filled, and it was inevitable. Again, it's negligent of the authorities to leave that space there. And Nike said, fine, we'll put our shoe in that space. And then in 2018, so now we're talking 2 years after the introduction of the prototype, of the Vaporfly, I guess under some pressure, the IAAF says, actually, you know what, we do need something. So they put a policy in saying that athletes must use a shoe that is reasonably available to all. And that was their stopgap, you know, like that was the little boy who stuck his finger in the dike at that time. And that's why I laughed when I saw the policy last week, because they basically said no prototypes allowed. Well, yes, that was already your policy. You've basically just reminded yourself of what you already said you'd be doing.
Yeah.
And it was heralded as a good step. To me, it was a non-step, emperor's clothes.
Maybe it's worthwhile just also, I know you've used this analogy a lot in the past, a lot of people will say that technological advancement in sport is inevitable and all sports have that, but you've used the example of tennis.
Yeah.
Just give us an idea of why the shoe is so problematic.
So if we try and deconstruct sport down to its most basic element, it's that the result has to have meaning. It has to mean something. And every sport, I think, decides a little bit for itself what that meaning is. So when you watch Formula One, the guy who wins the driver's championship is almost invariably in the same car that is winning the constructor's championship, because you understand that there's a synergy between driver and car. And in actual fact, the sport is a showcase for tech. Similarly, sailing is like that. The America's Cup is very good sailors, but unbelievably impressive boats. But then on the other extreme, I think running is the sport where you don't want the result to be determined by equipment. I mean, it's the one sport that's supposed to be pure. Now, that doesn't mean barefoot. And I get this often from people. I think it's an unbelievably simplistic view of looking at it. They'll say, but of course, innovation is improving. If you look back in the 1950s compared to now and you think about waffle soles and then air cushions and all this sort of innovation in shoes. But again, like, does anyone legitimately want to have a debate about whether Eliud Kipchoge is a better marathon runner than Jim Peters? Of course not. We know that he is because they're 60 years apart in terms of career. And so we accept that over time there is a creep of innovation and technology and knowledge that makes us better. But when the technology is introduced suddenly and it causes a step change, a large step change in performance, then we have a different issue. Because the fundamental principle of running is that you want to see human physiology rewarded. So I want to know that the guy who wins London or Chicago or Berlin or the Olympic marathon is physiologically the best athlete because they've got the genes, they've done the training, they've adapted to the training, they've got the tactics right, and their psychology is optimal. So they're all human elements. When you can now put a thing on your foot that changes what you get for the same human elements, that to me distorts the race result. So coming back to your question, when I'm watching the Australian Open final last weekend and it's going into a fifth set, not for a second do I think, man, I wish the Dominic team could play with Djokovic's tennis racket because then this result would be different. Yeah. Similarly, if I'm ever watching boxing, and this is not common, I'm not watching, this weekend is Fury and Wilder, I think. I'm not watching that saying, if only boxer A was fighting with boxer B's gloves, I reckon he could have knocked him out.
Yeah.
That's not what that sport means. And tennis is not about who's got a better tennis racket, and running should not be about who's got a better shoe.
Yeah.
So why is this such a big deal? And I think non-runners maybe miss this and other people distort this. When there's a world record or a national record or a PB, and this doesn't apply to an elite guy running 2:02, it applies also to a guy breaking 50 minutes for a 10K. That performance is celebrated as a human breakthrough. It belongs to me. And the problem with technology and running is that it changes the relationship between the input, the physiology of the human, and what happens on the clock in a way that I think then distorts it. So we now have to recalibrate running. We can't interpret a 2:04 marathon in the same context that we did two years ago, because 2:04 today means 2:07 back then.
Yeah.
And so I think the whole thing is upside down and mixed up. It's turbulent now, you know? It used to be quite smooth. We knew exactly what things meant. Now we don't, because of something you can buy and then put on your feet, and it changes the sport. And that's not what running should be.
And that 204, that is what used to be a 207, is applies to those athletes wearing that particular shoe at the moment.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's been the biggest problem. So the whatever light you think there is at the end of the tunnel is because you think that maybe other brands will catch up.
Yeah.
And so this
Why
depends.
Can't they?
Well, we'll get there when we speak to Jeff, I think, in more detail. But it depends, I think, on your level of optimism as to whether you think that this is going to happen in the next 1 month, 6 months, 12 months, 2 years.
Yeah.
Are those brands going to be able to do the same thing for their athletes that Nike has done for theirs? But for me, the governing body, World Athletics, have an obligation to ensure that meaning is defended in sport. It's literally the only thing that the governing body has to do.
Yeah,
is facilitate events and ensure that the results have meaning. That's why, and this is going like really high level, that's why men and women compete separately. Because if they didn't, women's results would have no meaning. That's why we don't let 25-year-olds play against 16-year-olds, because we have age separation so that there's meaning.
Yeah.
It's why Paralympic categories exist, because otherwise we'd be comparing a person with severe cerebral palsy to someone with mild cerebral palsy. So we create boundaries to give meaning to results. World Athletics had one job, and that's to ensure meaning in its results. They haven't done it for the last 4 years. They had a chance to do it moving forward, and for various reasons that we'll explore in the rest of this pod, they haven't done it now. And so I don't think running is going to change for the better in the next 12 months to 24 months, personally.
Well, let's take the next step in this evolution. What broadly speaking, well, not broadly, actually specifically, what did the regulations say that were released last week by World Athletics? What did they say about the shoe tech? What are the restrictions and the guidelines?
So for road shoes, the prototype issue, and again, as I said, that to me is the same thing it was before, except they've provided a bit of clarity around the time frame.
In other words, you can't have a prototype shoe in a competitive race. It has to be freely available.
You can't show up at the start line of London or Chicago in a shoe that's not on sale to all, either online or in stores. That's basically their wording.
Why is that important?
And it has to have been on sale for 4 months.
Okay. Why is that important?
That's important because they don't want shoes that have never been seen before with the capacity to create performance advantages and undermine integrity to be debuted without some oversight, I guess.
And also anybody can buy them. So if you're an athlete, you can purchase them. You don't have to be sponsored them.
Yes, in theory you can. I think in the real world, if you understand the commercial model that underpins running, is really there's one category of sponsor, and it's apparel manufacturers, and it's mostly shoes. If you are an athlete who's getting $50,000 a year from New Balance, Saucony, Brooks, whatever it is, Asics, Adidas, do you want your athletes to choose to go against their contracts to buy and run in a different shoe? That's another issue. But yeah, I think people simplistically say, well, at least now they can all go to the shop and buy their own shoes and race equally. I don't think that that's the case anyway because of responders, non-responders. That's another issue. But yes, the prototype rule has now been clarified, and they've promised us, pinky swore, that they are going to enforce it in the future. And then the second category of changes is that they've put in a list of technical specs around the makeup of the shoe. And the main one, the most striking one, is that they've limited the stack height to 40 millimeters. So this is the height of the shoe, basically. And you can see this in the midsole. This is what Jeff Burns, who was our guest in part one of The Shoe That Broke Running, suggested. He and a former student of mine, Nick Tam, wrote a piece in the British Journal of Sports Medicine in which they first suggested that idea, and it turns out that that's what they've done, except they've drawn that line at 40 millimeters. Other modifications are that they've said that you can have a single carbon fiber plate, or if there are more than one plates, they have to be on the same plane. They can't be staggered or stacked or overlapping. So there's a few technical specs there. But the main one really is that they've allowed carbon fiber, and they've allowed the thickness of the shoe, which to me is the source of the problem. In my opinion, the problem that developed between 2016 and 2020 could have been dealt with completely if they had reduced the stack height down to, say, 20 millimeters. And the problem is, as a deviation slightly here, when you give an engineer 40 millimeters of space to work inside, he can do all kinds of things with that carbon fiber plate and the foam. And so the key that unlocked this breakthrough really was, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to curve that plate. Because flat plates don't achieve the same performance benefits as a curved plate. But they couldn't curve the plate in the past because they didn't have the space to work in. So if you think of the midsole of a shoe almost as the scaffolding, the thicker it is, the more scaffolding you have, the more you can curve that plate. And that's really what I think they managed to do. And that's why, in my opinion, I was disappointed with the regulations that came out, because 40 millimeters does not take the root cause of the issue away. I felt that they could have gone to 20 millimeters, or better solution would have been to look back over the last 30 years of marathons and tested to say, what is the typical stack height of a racing shoe from, let's say, 1990 to 2016? And then just set the limit at that point. Yeah. And then let people innovate in that space. If it's 20 millimeters or 17 millimeters, fine. Go nuts inside a 17 millimeter space. Then you don't have to worry about prototypes. You don't have to worry about carbon fiber plates, because there's no room to put all these gimmicks in. So I think that they really missed an opportunity to do a simple and effective thing that would have restored the integrity of competition results. Whereas what they've done now is they've created more uncertainty and made it clumsier and less transparent, I think, than it was before.
Yeah, what's interesting is that obviously a lot of the shoe brands have responded. You know, Brooks have brought out a shoe with a carbon plate. I know New Balance have brought one out. Asics have brought out all sorts of different shoes. So there is obviously a big rush to get this technology going, and they will have to be in within that sort of new rules. But what's fascinating, and I think Ambi Burford, who is one of the probably the most respected voice in road running in the States, he's a longtime editor of Runner's World magazine in the States, actually tweeted a tweet, and I think you might even have it on your phone, who kind of alluded to the fact that Nike released this new shoe, which is completely compliant, just 4 days after World Athletics had announced these rules. So yeah, maybe you want to just read the tweet.
So they either got unbelievably lucky, right? Because who would have thought it'd be 40 millimeters?
Yeah.
I think actually it was really obvious what they were going to do. Because as I said, they had an opportunity to fix it.
Yeah.
But they were never going to do it, because it would have made the two shoes, you know, if they'd set that limit to 20 millimeters, those two shoes, the Vaporfly and the Next Percent, were gone. And there's no way they were going to do that. Nike's influence is too strong in the sport for them to do that. And so I remember writing 2 weeks ago, a prediction was that they'd set it at around 40 to 45, because that would allow the shoes that had been used to continue they would have satisfied Nike. So then they come out and they say 40 millimeters. So that's a correct prediction. And then Ambi Burford says, let's see. First, actually, a couple of days before the decision comes out, he says, if you were king, what would your rule be? He says a midsole height should be set at whatever Koskaya's shoes were when she broke the world record. And he thought that was 36 millimeters. So then they come out, and so Nike Next had a midsole thickness of 36 to 37. World Athletics announced a new rule at 40. Why? Because why go for? Why give them 4 millimeters more than anything out there anyway?
Especially when it's open to abuse at this point.
Yeah. Why higher than Koskaya's world record shoe? Ambi asks. Then Nike announced the new Alphafly Next Percent at 39.5. Oh, now I get it, is what Ambi wrote. And that's exactly what it is. So they've either been unbelievably lucky, or they knew exactly what was happening. And that's why I've said, it seems to me that there's as much chance that these regulations were written to fit the shoe than the shoe was made to fit the regulations.
I mean, this is quite a serious, if this is true, and obviously we need to make sure that this story is followed up. I'm sure there's a lot of journalists who are looking into the story, but it is a very serious matter that if Nike have had the short conversation with World Athletics and Seb Coe, they've got the heads up ahead of the announcement, and essentially they've been given the whole shot into that technological gaps, because it's going to take a long time for the other brands to be able to catch up to Nike. So this year's Olympic Games is almost inevitably going to be dominated in the distance events by not only the Nike shoe in the marathon distance, but also in the sprint distances as well. They brought out a new spike, which is again controversial.
We haven't even got to that. But just on this, I mean, this coincidence of the new Alphafly Next Percent being exactly at the limit set by Athletics is too coincidental to be left alone. So Sean Engel from The Guardian contacted them, and he asked them about it. And World Athletics insisted that they had not spoken to Nike specifically in giving them a warning. So a World Athletics spokesman told The Guardian, "We spoke to several shoe companies, including Nike, a few days before we released our new regulations to let them know what we were planning. But that was the extent of it." So if you believe that, then you believe that Nike just got really lucky at 40 millimeters.
And you know what? Then, tonight when I get home, I'm putting my child's tooth underneath the pillow because there's definitely a tooth fairy.
And then the other thing the spokesman says is the working group created the rules based on what was already available. Well, that's the whole problem here. Like, you guys sat for 4 years and let things become available and then tell everyone, poor us, we couldn't change what was already available. The whole problem had developed because they didn't do anything when they should have.
Yeah.
And now they're saying we can't do anything. It's just unbelievably poor, weak, flaccid, impotent leadership, in my opinion. And that 40 millimeters, and this is, we get into a conversation with Jeff, I guess.
I mean, the thing is, anybody listening to this podcast, and please engage with us on Twitter and tell us if we're missing something here, because when I read that response from World Athletics, the timeline suggests that it is impossible for Nike to produce a shoe even a couple of weeks in advance of this announcement. And if they did, they were extremely lucky. It doesn't make sense that there wasn't some form of collusion. And I don't want to use that word because there might be some libel cases, but it just seems like it was, as you said, the shoe, the regulations have been built to fit the shoe rather than the other way around.
That's what it looks like.
And, yeah,
and
for
I mean,
sure.
But even if it's not, and even if you want to believe that this is whiter than snow, and I don't believe that because heck, this is sports governance and we all know what that's like. The problem is that at 40 millimeters, you've now got a market for shoes that other companies have to respond to.
Yeah.
Because now you've codified that performance enhancement through footwear is a thing.
And you've got all the patents to go with it.
Well, Nike's got the patents,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So World Athletics has codified and formalized the arms race, the shoe race. Such an obvious pun. So every company now has to say, right, let's invest, let's go for this. They're going to come up against a couple things. Number one is patents, because there are certain things they won't be able to do. And so one of the big questions to look out for now is whether it's possible to create the same performance enhancement without violating a patent. In other words, are there two ways to skin a cat? Are there two ways to make a runner propel forward with less energy cost? So some companies are going to be creative. Like, I know that one of them has got two plates, but on the same plane. Another company's got a plate that spans 3/4 of the shoe, not the full length. So this is how they're sidestepping the patents. The question remains is, does that sidestep compromise the effectiveness of the shoe? Yes or no? Because if it does, then this separation between haves and have-nots doesn't get different. It might get smaller, but it's not going to disappear, right? So Nike will always have a 1-2% head start because of legal matters. So lawyers will probably decide medals going forward in the immediate short to medium term future. Even bigger than that, in my opinion, is that even if all the other companies match Nike's advances, you've still got a shoe that in studies has been found to improve performance in some people by 6% and in other people by none at all.
Yeah.
Now, responders, non-responders is a thing to everything in the world. Aspirin, you and I could take the same number of aspirins for a headache and we get different effects. Shoes is no different. So we know that people who put on the same pair of shoes might see slightly different responses. But the bigger the effect of the shoe gets, the bigger the response range will be. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Because if the average is 1%, then your outlier gets 1.5, 2, and your non-person gets 0. If the average is 5%, 6%, now your outlier's got 10.
Yeah.
And your non-responder's got 0. And that difference means that, you know, we always used to look at runners and say, that guy there, that champion marathon runner, that's VO2 max, that's lung capacity, that's heart, muscles, economy, lactate threshold. In the future, given this policy, it'll be about saying, that guy there, he's great because he responds really well to shoes.
Yeah.
That's what we've created running to be now, is a sport where your capacity to get the benefit of your equipment makes a bigger difference than your physiology.
Yeah.
And that's not running.
So if there was one word to describe that, to describe this whole scenario, it's about integrity, really.
Yeah,
isn't it? And that's exactly what it is. If you boil it all the way down, it's about integrity.
Exactly. That's what it is. And you know, there's different degrees to which you can take the integrity out of something. When you've got three athletes in a race wearing a shoe 4% better than everyone else, there's zero integrity.
Yeah.
And that was the Olympic Games in 2016 because there were three guys there. And so that was the US Olympic trials in 2016. That's why Gaucho was so unhappy about that, because you know, that's the difference between going to your final Olympic Games and watching it on the television. So then you've got zero. At least, and I'm trying to find a silver lining, at least now we've got the prospect of some integrity, but it's not going to be there. Like, and this policy cannot achieve what its intention should be. Again, what should the intention of this policy be? To reestablish meaning in the results of running events. Can it achieve that? No, because it's murky, uncertain, inherently will never create parity because of responders, non-responders, inaccessible. I mean, just think about how this percolates down the system.
Yeah.
From school to college to professional ranks. If you don't have a shoe, you are 5% behind your rivals at school level.
Yeah.
Which means that to be noticed, you must be 5% better than everyone else. Or you have to have the shoe.
It's a barrier to entry.
Exactly.
For some athletes.
And that's what swimming considered when they banned their swimsuits, which is the best, most recent example of this happening, is this distortion of physiology determining the result as opposed to equipment. Equipment starts to make a bigger difference to the outcome than the human does, and you have to then get rid of it. And they didn't do it. In fact, they formalized a process by which it can never happen.
Right, so time to welcome our special guest onto our podcast today, Jeffrey Burns, who is a biomechanist all the way from the University of Michigan. And I know that Jeffrey is sitting in very cold, wintry, snowy conditions in Michigan as we talk to him, as we sit in 28 degrees Celsius with air conditioning. But Jeffrey, I mean, it's been a massive couple of months, but probably an even bigger last week in the world of biomechanics in sport over this whole shoe debate.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Yeah, things escalated quickly in the last week.
Tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, we've kind of given a bit of a précis as to how things happened and everything from 2016. But now in the last week, we've seen the new regulations. We've seen Nike coincidentally just bringing out a shoe that matches those regulations almost perfectly. What is your sort of broad strokes view of the shoe and the happenings of the last couple of days with the regulations?
Yeah, it was really a lot to take in at once, because at first pass, you know, last week we had the regulations come out, and my first thought was that they seemed sensible, like a good compromise to include all the production models that we have out there. They capped at, you know, 40 millimeters. And my thought was that's because that's what the upper spectrum of Vaporflies fall under. That's kind of where it was. I had, you know, we can get into this later, but I had a couple initial reactions that would have tweaked with the rules the way they were worded. But then the spike rules kind of smelled a little funny to me, because that 30 millimeters on a spike is so much more than any conventional production spike right now. So I saw that and that was like, wow, that definitely leaves a lot of space. And, you know, the elephant just waiting right outside the room is the, you know, Nike spikes that we saw last year in Doha.
Might I suggest that the elephant wrote the regulations?
Yeah. So it was right there, and it seems kind of like it was ushering those in. And so kind of balancing those two left me scratching my head a little bit. But on the whole, I thought the road racing shoes was kind of in the spirit of preserving what was out. And we even saw, it was interesting, we even saw comments from Sebastian Coe, something to the effect of, we couldn't expect to, you know, feasibly roll back production models right now in time for the Olympics. And so this was an effort to leave it at that. And so when I saw that, and that was like the day that the regulations were released, I thought that's what the spirit of the rules were. And then little did we know what was in store. You know, was it a couple of days ago? Now the Alphafly comes out and really bucks that. And you could see that there is clearly some space left to be there. And now we're left scratching our heads.
But again. I mean, just you and I have discussed over the last week since the regs were announced, and you say that the compromise seemed sensible and that they couldn't intervene on what was already available. Don't you think that's giving them a lot of leeway, given that their inaction in the first place allowed the market to take on the shape that it's got today, and then they decided not to intervene? So effectively, they were complicit in its generation and then in its continuation. There's no reason at all that they could have made that stack height limit lower. And what would the downside of that really have been, other than to take away the thing that's hurt the integrity of the sport in the last 3 years?
So I agree that they could have taken that tact of being much stricter and just axing it there and making it lower. But the way I interpreted it, perhaps optimistically, was that this was, you know, if we can think of this thing like a ball rolling down the hill, this was stopping the ball in time for the Olympics, because we had, you know, Alex Hutchinson made a good point when he had interviewed Reed Coolset, who was trying to qualify for the Olympics, made the point that he was going to try and qualify with these shoes, because we've had 2 years of people meeting qualification standards in these shoes. So like you said, it's this quagmire that they got themselves into, and to cap it right now and then prevent other people from, you know, whether it's meeting the qualification standards or something for the Olympics, would be unfair to those people who are trying to do it now in the shoes. And again, it's not right, but perhaps it's the best tact for a couple months until the Olympics. So that's where I was thinking of it like, okay, this caps it where we're at now. And we have a frame. This is the important thing, is they laid out a framework for the rule, which we never had in the past. So we have a framework, cap it now, don't let it evolve any further. And then, again, the optimist in me thinking, then we can go back and revisit it after the Olympics and tighten it up in perpetuity. And that way, being fair to the people who have gotten where they are, as well as, you know, allowing ourselves to move forward with it. I mean, I 100% agree with you that they're in a mess of their own making, and it's going to be getting out of it. It's going to be painful. It's just, you know, do they want it to be painful long term, or do they want it to be painful short term? You know.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. So when you see the Alphafly, and I mean, we're going to get on, I think, to lots of specifics so that we can tap your biomechanics expertise in particular. When you see the Alphafly Next Percent announced the other day, and it's a hair's width under the limit, and it's got this air pod in the front, does that make you think that the regulations needed to be tighter, or is this the inevitable consequence and we can now expect all the other brands to imitate over the next six to 12 months?
There are a couple points to be made about this. I think, one, the regulations, I mean, again, my personal preference with the regulations is that we would make it as close to what conventional racing flats used to be, because, as we discussed last time, the less and less and less real estate that you allow, the less and less and less, you know, really deviant advancements in, you know, a beneficial technology that you can fit in that space, essentially.
Yeah, the scaffold, yeah.
So the tighter that you make it, the less of an effect it can have. With the Alphafly, it actually speaks to my first criticism of the rule as it's written. When I first read it, and there's the line when they were talking about how it will deviate from, I don't know, I don't have the rule right here with me, I can pull it up, but it's something to the effect of marginal increases in sole thickness across heights. Like, we'll measure it at an EU 42, there will be marginal increases with like larger shoes. And when I saw that, I just like facepalm, marginal increases. No, like, you need to have operational, concrete rhetoric and words. It's a regulation. Again, like, the, you know, the old regulations and many of the current ones are still written like loopholes, not like actual regulations. Like, they're just these fuzzy words that you can dance around. And so to say that the height, the thickness would increase marginally with the length of the shoe, it's like, no, you need, if I was writing the rule specifically, would have written some sort of length to height, you know, relation. We have, you know, if you look at all of the field event implements, you have diameters based on shot put weight, you know, discus weights, the different dimensions of them, they scale. Shoes, for anybody who's spent time, you know, whether it's around a large size run of running shoes, shoes scale with length, the thickness of them. So
yeah, so if I can just interrupt you there, because I think this is a technical point that the listeners will enjoy, because you covered it in part one, is that stack height is important because, A, it provides the scaffolding, you called it real estate, to do the fancy things inside of. But the other interesting thing you introduced us to last time was that when you lengthen the length of the when you increase the length of the leg, then you create all by itself a performance benefit. And you're saying that that is disproportionately large for a shorter athlete, and potentially one with a smaller foot. So when you don't have a height that is in comparison or relative to the length of the shoe, then you end up distorting this benefit as well, yes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a disproportional increase in the effective leg length of the runner. And then moreover, on top of that, you can think of it from a purely mechanical standpoint too, of that foam is, again, this gets back to the idea, all shoes are springs, things that, you know, they just work to different efficiencies. If we're storing and releasing strain energy in that spring, the amount of strain energy that you can store and release is proportional to the length of the spring. Yeah. So a 20 millimeter, 30 millimeter, 40 millimeter spring, that amount of absolute strain energy that's increased, that's stored and released, in, like, you know, scales with the length of that. So, you know, you have, like I said, that needs to be scaled by the length of the shoe. And that, again, that was something that in the proposal, especially, you know, the one that we wrote in BJSM, didn't get into the technical details of that, because that was, you know, more introducing the general concept of this. My hope was that, like, somebody sitting down to pen this rule would recognize that, but, you know, maybe not.
Out of interest, did anyone making this rule consult with you or any other biomechanist that you know to get input on these specific things, just out of curiosity?
So I never heard from World Athletics. They, you know, I had only heard that they had two biomechanists on the committee, but I had never heard that who they actually were. No word. But even then, that is, to me, maybe a biomechanist would understand that, but I guess a lot of biomechanists perhaps aren't tuned, like, they could understand that theoretical maybe side of it, but aren't tuned necessarily to the specifics of shoe manufacturing, maybe would overlook that. Like I said, if you, like, you know, when I was in high school and college, I worked in a running shoe store. So spent a lot of time with footwear, but shoes scale, I think, on the order. It depends shoe to shoe. And you would have to, again, they had industry people on the committee, so they could have easily consulted this, or at least from what I hear. But it's around, you know, a US size, about a millimeter a size, it would scale the thickness of the shoe. And again, that'll change shoe to shoe, but that's a general trend that I would say, which would hold, which is about maybe half a millimeter per EU size. So So yeah, so that's broadly speaking, that was one of the first things that jumped out to me, was like allowing that tolerance by saying we will allow marginal increases in sole thickness based on longer shoes. I saw that, I'm like, if you are giving that to a company that, you know, or a person, like people who have a reputation of walking up to the line and leaning over it as far as they possibly can, you know, this essentially doesn't give them a line. It gives them like an enormous prairie to go walk in and dance around.
Yeah.
And so that to me was the thing that I saw and was like, again, the optimist in me was like, maybe we won't have to deal with this time around. You know, this will get tightened up later. And then sure enough, like 5 days later, it was just massive, you know, they made a show of it.
I can tell that you're trying hard to be the optimist and to bring that side of you out. But the cynic in me says, give it time.
Yeah.
I mean, what's interesting, I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but I saw a video of you I think it was late last year, did a video on the Wall Street Journal, I think it was, or some sort of website where you were talking, they were asking you about your recommendations, and you mentioned the 40 millimeter heel as a kind of a number. Was that really what you kind of put out there? I mean, it's kind of ironic that they've gone that way, but is that a sort of a standard number that people in your profession thought would be an ideal heel height?
Well, we use that because that's, like I said, that's what the upper spectrum of the vapor, like the upper size runs of the vapor ply. So if we think of like US sizes are, you know, 12, 13, 14 are the highest ones. What that translates to EU is that
45.
Is that like 46, 47, 48? Anyways, that's what the largest models of the Vaporfly will be right around 40 millimeters.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought it would be.
Yeah, I think it's always,
the highest thickness of the Alphafly is probably going to be like 48, 49 on those. So,
I know we're going to get into some of the technical side of things as well, but I've just got one other question, and I'm just interested to hear from you as an elite athlete yourself. Obviously, you've done a many ultra distance events. How does this feel for you as an athlete with what's going on? I don't know if you're sponsored by a particular brand, but if you're not sponsored by Nike, what do you think the athletes feel about this, and what do you think the general consensus is amongst competitive athletes?
You know, this is actually one of the most fascinating things about this whole debate, and that I would love to have a consortium of athletes like speaking anonymously off the record, both Nike athletes and non-Nike athletes, because one of the things that's made this most challenging is that athletes can't really speak out about this, and they're the ones, you know, directly participating. So I used to have a shoe sponsorship. I was sponsored by Ultra Running. ALTRA. And I recently I've foregone that sponsorship for kind of personal and scientific reasons, independent of the shoe issue, but more so because I feel like I strongly identify with being kind of an independent runner, and it's also, I think, important as a scientist, especially if I'm going to be involved in these conversations. For the athletes that are sponsored by, you know, other companies, and especially when you're looking at the elite road racing scene, it's a really challenging place. And I think that they were left in kind of with the new regulation, a spot of thinking like, okay, we've got shoes coming out that might be close, that get us there. We can deal with this. And then I think this wave, this might be a tipping point. And this is something I want to get to maybe later in the conversation about the effect of this. But for athletes, it's definitely, I look at it now as somebody who is an athlete outside the spectrum of shoe sponsorship. And I think, like, scientifically speaking, it doesn't make sense to be racing in anything else. It's really sad to say that, but it's the reality of the shoes. And I also think from the standpoint of, you know, if you are a top level Nike athlete right now, and I mean, when I say top level, I mean, this is even just maybe only a handful of their world-class athletes where they can modify some features of the shoe to the specific athlete. Other than that, it's just one shoe that you have to adapt to and work with, you know, which again, is something that me personally as an athlete, I've been in the shoe, but I haven't done a lot of like faster work in it or anything like that, let alone race in it yet. And I look at it and I'm like, I don't even know if it'll work, you know, mechanically, you know, how I will interact with the shoe. And if that's the only option for a faster racing shoe for a lot of athletes, that's challenging. But then it gets back to the sponsorship side too, and the athletes from the other brands. The thing that is not being had in this conversation right now is the voice of all the professional athletes out there that aren't part of this, because they're in a catch 22. They can't voice their real opinions, because to do so would be to come at the detriment of their own brand. It would be talking negatively about their own footwear.
Yeah.
You know, the sponsor that pays them, but then it also flips it, because then they can't also express their real feelings about this subject to the authorities and the fans and the broader sport. So I think that's a piece that's really missing from this conversation. And moreover, we also don't get to hear the real insight from Nike athletes. You know, they obviously have to essentially toe the company line. There may be some that, you know, there are a lot that love it and embrace it, but maybe there are some that don't think it has a place, or that think it's gone too far, would be totally okay with rolling, you know, regulations back, but they can't say that.
Yeah, I think the problem is that if you speak against it, you're labeled disgruntled, jealous, unhappy, loser. And if you speak for it, then you're assigned the alternative label. And that eventually means that athletes can't speak, only outsiders. But outsiders, by nature, have less credibility in some of the things you need to hear about. So I think it has been a shame. And again, I mean, you spoke a little bit about who was on that panel in the process. I think that they could have worked harder to get that voice out anonymously. So there's a few flaws there for sure, definitely in the process.
I think, I mean, I know we can't canvass every single non-Nike athlete, but I kind of feel that if you were a non-Nike athlete and you couldn't wear Nike shoes, and as you said, it's the preferential shoe, makes sense to always wear that if you can. All those athletes who can't wear their shoes going, basically, we're screwed. Is it as simple as that?
I can't tell you what's going on inside their head. I mean, I can tell you what was going on inside my head when I looked at it, like, pragmatically. Was, yeah, that shoe's way better. Like, it's that you're at a huge disadvantage. You're spotting these people. I mean, I had this case, like, personally, at the World Championships in the 100K 2 years ago. Guys, you know, I was fifth place, and four of the five guys in front of me were in the Vaporfly. And, you know, I look at that, and that's over 100K. That's, you know, generously speaking, probably 6-7 minutes, maybe more. And so I look at it, and that's the reality, is like spotting those people that time. And I, you know, the flip side of it that you deal with as an athlete is like, you're racing in the shoes that you most fundamentally enjoy the sport in. And so you have that, and it's, you know, this will get into like something that will probably pique a lot of people, but you know, it's almost like the same conversation that, like you hear, you know, clean athletes will always say this when they know that they're on the line against athletes who are using drugs. It's like, at the end of the day, this is for me. So it's like the athletes are kind of relegated to that. And that's not to say that athletes in the shoes are breaking the rule like that. But the idea that it's like, well, maybe then at the end of the day, the thing you're holding on to is just that you're doing the performance that is in the spirit of the sport, you know, to which you identify with.
Yeah. So on that, I mean, let's talk about the regs as they are now. This is the 7th of February, and we've got these regulations, and we are now anticipating that half a dozen companies are in a position to at least make their first response. And then, in theory, moving forward, they can make their next responses. Although
the timeframes given to us by World Athletics mean that won't affect the Olympic Games. But in your perception, how close do you think other brands are to bridging that gap, even partly as opposed to fully?
I can't imagine. When I saw the first iterations of the shoes that I've seen from, I think the brands, let's see, it looks like Adidas, Saucony, New Balance, and Brooks all definitely have ones that I'm aware of. Those iterations that I've seen, I looked at them and thought, like, based on the foams and the plates in the shoes, my impressions were that they maybe got halfway there, you know, to the original Vaporfly.
Yeah, which is 3 years ago.
Okay, so the next percent is you know, presumably better than the Vaporfly a little bit. And then the Alphafly is, you know, it seems like it's quite a bit better than those. So it seems like they're now, you know, they may now be back to being 3-4%, you know, percentage points behind on that front compared to that. And I'll give you my rationale for saying that is you look at, I think it's helpful. We don't have any laboratory tests on these shoes. All we have is reviews from, of course, the athletes who are, you know, towing their company line that says, oh yeah, this shoe's great, blah, blah, blah. I will say to Saucony's credit, they did, Jared Ward did one of the, he did one of the replications studies on
Hunter Ward,
the BYU lab.
Yeah,
he's with Saucony, and so I imagine he was testing his shoes against the Vaporfly, and perhaps he was happy with how close they got. I'm still not entirely convinced that they are quite as good, and certainly probably not as good as the next percent in the newest iterations. But getting back to why I was thinking that. I think it's helpful to first look at the materials in the shoes. I think the Saucony one is like half PBAX and half TPU. Not sure about the formulation of PBAX, but that's one of the defining features of shoes that helps it harness the energy return. It's heavier than the Vaporfly, which would make me skeptical.
Yeah.
I think the Brooks shoe is EVA based, which would give me great pause. The one that I'm very curious about that we actually haven't seen anything with yet, except a few pictures, is Adidas. Adidas has one coming out that I think will be quite thick, that is supposed to not, I don't know if it even uses plates, but it has some sort of rigid structure.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's compliant with the policy, because it might use more than one plate or different shapes or something. So this is an unknown question. But yeah, I've seen that shoe. That was the shoe that was used in Houston recently, no?
Similar to it, yeah. And I think they've actually further iterated on that one that was in Houston. That it looks like they're finally playing around with kind of some new, you know, new copolymers as well, like whether it's PBAX or something similar. So that could be a response. But again, this is one of the things that speaks to the broader challenge of this. Is one of the beautiful things about the Vaporfly was that we had several really, really high quality laboratory studies done on these. Like that first Colorado study was a dream of scientific control of shoe comparisons. We've probably, you know, in the history of biomechanics, like, to have that explicit and well controlled of a study is very novel. We don't get that with shoes very often. And then we had that replicated across other studies. We're not going to get that for each one of these new shoes, so we'll never know. We probably won't even, you know, we might not even get studies done on these new shoes, let alone repeated studies, let alone well-controlled, you know, crossover studies like that. So that's one of the things that gives me.
Sorry, like, Jeff, why do you say we won't get studies like that? I would imagine that there'd be a dozen universities around the world who would be absolutely desperate to get their hands on,
you know, 10 pairs of the Brooks or the Saucony or the Adidas, the Asics one, and then do those studies, because they're not that difficult studies to do, you know. Some of the mechanical stuff with the Intron and so forth, yes, but certainly at the most basic level, measuring oxygen consumption, I mean, you could do that in a week.
Well, I will say, to the credit of because these changes are so noisy, you need to do robust repeated testing. So you look at like the Colorado study, for example, you know, they did it at 4 speeds and they did a randomized mirrored crossover of all those shoes. So they're essentially doing 6 trials in each shoe in 20 runners or 18 runners, I think they had 18 or 19. 6 trials in each shoe at each speed. So that's 24 trials per athlete. So that suddenly you start doing that, and that's, you know, 4 visits to the lab. That's a lot. I mean, that's a lot of testing. Mm. And yeah, you could, assuming you can recruit the subjects, you could do the actual testing in a couple weeks. But then it gets back to, you know, whether it's getting the shoes and you know, prioritizing that with resources. That's like the study that we all want to do. But again, it gets back to the funding and whatnot to do that. And if it's the shoe companies that put it up, that's, you know, again, the optimist in me thinks like, well, maybe that's great. Maybe now shoe companies will say like, yeah, we'll fund these studies at universities, give you size runs and do the comparison. But on the flip side, you know, someone like Nike, you know, perhaps probably only funded that study because they knew, you know, they knew how good this shoe was. And so they were like, let's do this awesome, robust study because we know it's going to squash everything. We want it to be independent. If you do that with Saucony and ask us to compare that to the Vaporfly, I don't know if you're going to see the results that you want to see.
You heard that interview with Kip on Let's Run. And she said that when that shoe arrived at them, it already had a reputation as a 3% shoe. So whatever internal testing we'd done, they knew that, and then they called it the magic. So I agree, but let's put it out there, because I know some people listen to this podcast. If you happen to have a supply of shoes and you would like them to be tested, Jeff is your man. Email me, find Jeff on Twitter or find me on Twitter and send Jeff your shoes. I'll consult. You do the study. It'll be great fun. Because I do think it is interesting to see what other shoes are able to do. If we go on from that and we talk about the regs a little bit more, I know that you raised a few issues around implementation. And in fact, when we last spoke in part one, my theory was that you could ban the carbon fiber plates. And you persuaded me that you don't need to do that as long as you keep the stack height low enough. They haven't kept the stack height low enough, so we are going to have carbon fiber plates. And they've created all these policies around the stacking and the overlap and the shape and so on. How are they going to implement this?
That was the other thing that I was hoping we would talk about today, because that was and I saw the rules on the carbon fiber plate. I was like, you know, I don't think this is necessary. Moreover, I don't know if I even care about that aspect of the rule so much, because again, I talked about this last time, I'm like, I'm very much of the opinion, if you're going to have something on your foot, like, and you want to put some construction in it, like, okay, whatever. But the actually litigating and regulating enforcing those regulations are going to be a nightmare. I don't know how they're going to do it. You know, I guess they say that the shoes need to be sent to World Athletics for compliance or, you know, approval. Maybe they'll cut the shoes up, but that's the ideal case. Clearly that's not followed. That used to be that rule. Interestingly, that rule was in the rule book in 2016 and 17, all types of competition shoes must be sent to the IAAF for approval. Clearly that was like, you know, not only did Nike not follow that, but I mean, sure, I'm sure no brand followed that.
Yeah, for sure.
It's clear that you could put something in a shoe, wear the shoe and have them never know. It's such a silly rule. It's funny. It's like there is the rule too that like plates have to be, if there are multiple plates, they have to be in the same plane, yeah. Something similar. I was thinking comically, like if something were to happen, your Vaporfly plate were to break because the plate curves down, it's not in the same plane. So a broken Vaporfly is actually out of regulation. just such silly rules. My thing with the midsole height regulation was like, if you set that restrictive enough or to something reasonable, like none of that really matters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's
just the more space we afford now, the more you can do.
Yeah, that's certainly, I mean, that when we spoke, as I said, you persuaded me of that. And I think that they could have solved two problems at the same time. They would have alleviated the implementation issue, and they would have created a policy or a framework that would have been more effective in curbing the performance enhancement available. Because at the moment, like, so carbon is radiolucent, yes, if I've used the word correctly. In other words, it doesn't show up on an X-ray. So X-ray is not enough. And I mean, seriously, how many racers are going to X-ray the shoes? So you need MRIs, or you need a hacksaw and a pair of honest eyes.
Yeah. And or so, CT. You could do it with a CT scan. Marginally cheaper than an MRI.
Even cheaper. So you can almost envisage a situation where you've got to hand your shoes into a box and pee into a cup. So you've got a doping problem and a shoe problem, and you've got two moving parts. And every time there's a result that needs to be questioned, we now have to ask, was he wearing compliant shoes, and was his blood compliant with the law? That's messy. I just think it's so unnecessarily complicated. Next point.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
The more it's really the more and more that equipment plays a role, more and more baggage it brings with it.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next thing is, and I saw you tweeted this, I think overnight, a link to an article on swimsuits back in the day and how it affected NCAA. Talk a little bit about some of the concerns and the issues facing shoes as you disseminate or percolate the issue down from the elite to the sub-elite into colleges and schools and so on.
Yeah, so this is what's going to be, you know, we're going to see this. We just saw that. I think we saw the tip of the iceberg last year when the, you know, last year was the first year that the Next Percent really became, the Vaporfly became widely available, right? Like it was before that, it was pretty hard to get pairs of the Vaporfly 4%. And we saw it start to trickle down into college ranks. Now this year, you know, then we saw it at the Hakone Ekiden in Japan, which if your listeners don't know, that similar to university sports in the US, you know, Japan has the very vibrant road racing scene. And one of the biggest sporting events on their sporting calendar is this road relay of universities. And much like in the NCAA, they have big lucrative sponsors with equipment manufacturers. So it's Adidas, Asics, Nike, Mizuno. Last year in 2018, you start to see the Vaporfly creep in. And then this year, literally every team is something like 85%+ of runners, no matter what sponsorship, were wearing the Vaporfly. So the team that won was an Adidas sponsored team. All 10 of their runners were wearing the Vaporfly. So we look at the NCAA in the US, and we know that this shoe makes a substantial difference, you know, at speeds that these guys are racing at 10K. So, and girls. So what was actually one of the really cool replication studies that was done was at Grand Valley State, and they compared the Vaporfly to the Nike Mutombo racing spike. So a track spike that's conventionally used in distance racing, there's a 3% benefit from the 4%, the Vaporfly to the Nike track spike. So we look at that in the context of the 10K. So now we're going to see a lot of guys racing in this shoe on the track, but that gets back to this question of access and availability. We have, you know, big division. So in the US, a lot of the Division I schools, the biggest universities, have equipment sponsorships. So whether it's Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, they have contractual obligations to these brands. Then you get down to the other, you know, divisions, the lower levels, Division II, Division III, they might not even have equipment sponsorships, and they might have to buy their own gear. So now we actually have two questions of access. One, at the top level, athletes are bound for the school that they choose to the footwear that they have to race in. And then at the very low level, you have college kids who might, you know, some might be able to afford it and some might not. So if we look at that very top level and the access, if you're an Adidas school and you're not allowed to race in these shoes, you are at a competitive disadvantage. I know, like Michigan, we're a Nike school. I know our 10K guys are going to be racing in the Vaporfly on the track. You know, I look at one of the powerhouse distance running schools in the U.S., Northern Arizona University, and I look at them, they're an Adidas school, and I'm like, man, are you guys, you know, what are you going to be racing in the 10K? Because that's the other thing that it gets back to is it's advantageous in a 10,000 meters. It could, you know, again, at the collegiate level, their 10,000 meter pace is slower than, you know, or around the same speed as elite marathon pace. So clearly the Vaporfly is well tuned to it for that speed. If that's going to make 30 seconds difference, 10K, that's mind-blowingly huge. Last year, the winner of the men's 10,000 meter, Clayton Young from BYU, was wearing the Vaporfly. The winner of the men's Division II was wearing the Vaporfly.
Yeah, so, but of course, he won't need to this time because the IAAF World Athletics, in their wisdom, have approved a spike with a 30-millimeter midsole, which will be worn by everyone. So they'll be in spikes. They won't need to wear road shoes and they'll obliterate records anyway. Yes.
Well, that's actually one of the interesting things is that that's 30 millimeters for spike shoes, but you could still wear racing flats on the track and be, you know, the alpha fly. You could theoretically wear the alpha fly on the track because it doesn't have spikes. So
I guess what I was getting at, I was sort of segueing towards the spike conversation because a lot of people's eyebrows went up, like you said, yours did, because You can understand. I mean, I understand, though I disagree with the 40-millimeter limit. But the 30-millimeter limit that they've imposed for spikes doesn't seem to have any real basis other than to allow Nike to continue doing what they seem to have seeded in Doha. So those who don't know, in Doha, there was a lot of confusion about this because it sounds as though there were two different versions of that spike. Sifan Hassan used it. Laura Muir was alleged to have used one, but maybe a different version. So no one really knows what was going on. But now World Athletics has effectively opened the door to that spike being used regularly. So maybe we can just speculate a little bit about that. I know you were circumspect about the benefit of that shoe. My view was the performances we saw from athletes in that spike in Doha were either doped or mechanically aided. How do you feel about the spike future?
Both. No, I certainly think the spike by its from what I can glean from its construction, I can certainly see how it's advantageous. I don't suspect it's on the order of what the Vaporfly is compared to road racing shoes, but compared to conventional spikes, I could certainly see how it could be a few percentage points, you know, an advantage. And if you're looking at 1 to 2 seconds over 1500, that's enormous. Like at an elite level, that's huge. Very much of the disposition that those spikes are beneficial. And it just, the underlying question to all of this is like, to what extent are we okay with that? I don't know what more to say on that. It's really the same. It's the same mechanical concepts as the shoes, just to a lesser degree. You have, if you're putting an air bladder underneath the forefoot of the spike and more foam underneath the heel, if that is, you know, again, extending the effective leg length of the runner by even a centimeter or so, with something that is, does it in a very, very, let's say almost nearly mass neutral way, and that it's ultra lightweight extension of that, you now have that kind of synthetic extension that stores and returns energy extremely well, that now gives, that could provide that mechanical advantage. One of the things that's interesting about those spikes, and again, it's hard to glean what might be going on with them without holding on to them. But those air bladders, you know, one of the things that's written into the patents on them is that there's a range of pressures to which the bladders will be. And that really sparked my interest because I was thinking, now I'm like, you could pressurize these anywhere from, I think they specified, I can't remember if it's like 15 Pascal or kilopascals to 25. I was like, wow, you know what's really interesting about that? And this is fascinating from a mechanical standpoint. I don't know if this has a role in competition, but from a mechanical side, this is fascinating. You could tune those bladders to different events, to different, because different events, you have different contact times and contact frequencies, your foot strike. Those bladders, the stiffness and the stiffness of the bladder under compression could be modulated with the pressure of it. Not to say you could change it on the spot, but you could make different spikes with different bladders tuned to different speeds and forces that you're striking the ground. And I was like, that's actually fascinating from a standpoint of like, being equipment and athlete specific.
Yeah.
Or event and athlete specific.
How does all this sit with you? Because if someone tuned into this podcast like in the last 15 seconds and heard you talking about this, they'd say, oh, how did I land up on a motorsports discussion? So how does this sit with you as a runner / biomechanist, if you can even differentiate those two things that you are? Because, and I've said this many times and I've said it for years, I'm very uncomfortable with the situation. You've said a few times, it's like, do we have to just decide if we are okay with that, this degree of enhancement? I'm just curious on your philosophical views.
Yeah, so, I as a scientist, am fascinated by these developments that we've had, but my personal disposition is that it doesn't have a place in competitive sport. As a runner, it's not the sport that I identify with. It's not a direction that it's making me fall out of love, with the sport. But what I get back to is I recognize that's a spectrum. Because the fundamental philosophical question that we get back to is equipment plays a role in our performances to some extent. Shoes, we are not running barefoot. We have shoes. But to what extent is that a role? And my feeling is I like to minimize that as much, as reasonable, so as to distill what I do as an act, an exercise of my physiology. The scientific side, it's a fascinating just time to see what we can do with locomotion and changing the body. But I think it's very much like, you have bikes and aerodynamic configurations that you can make a two-wheeled self-powered craft go crazy fast. And that's super fascinating to tweak that and do that. But they're not, we're not going to have those seated bikes and these carbon fiber shells in time trials in the Tour de France, right? There is a point where you draw that line between what is the sporting context and what is, engineering. And I think to me, the fundamental, this is the fundamental question is, when you cross the finish line and you look at the clock, to what extent do you want the number on that clock to be a feat of engineering?
Exactly. Yeah.
And again, that number, that extent is not zero for us right now. Again, we're not running barefoot, but I think that there's a point where it can be minimal and within the spirit of, the pillars on which the sport has been built. And even the last century, we've worn shoes by and large since the modern Olympic Games. And so I think, if we keep footwear in the spirit of what it was, we can keep that number, as minimal as reasonably possible. And that's the purpose of making regulations in sport. The more and more that equipment plays the role, the more and more that number on that clock is no longer, is not just a feat of physiology, it's a feat of engineering. And I say that as an engineer, those are what my bachelor's and master's degree, and I worked as a professional engineer for many years. And to me, it's like sport is the beautiful thing that is removed from that. You know, I'm a scientist to explore the human body and to tinker with these things. But I think the fundamental appeal to me when I got into running as a young kid was just that clarity, that experimental truth and clarity that I had of what I was doing physiologically, seeing the outputs come, you know, being able to conduct those experiments on myself with equipment that it's, you know, from an experimental design standpoint, equipment is a confounding variable. I always say, like, I think doping, to me, drugs and doping in sport is so egregious because races and race results and performances are data, right? They're beautiful data that we have. They're trials run, they're experiments conducted, comparisons made. Doping is data falsification. And I think that the equipment that we're seeing now is maybe it's confounding factors. It's a confounding variable in our data, right? So now our beautiful experiments that we're having play out, whether it's between two people or even within ourselves, are becoming noisier and noisier. And we don't necessarily, it's really hard to understand how to correct for those confounding variables. And that's what's so difficult. Yep. Again, nailed so it. The scientist in me is fascinated by it, but I am, you know, I don't know if I'm a runner because I'm a scientist or if I'm a scientist because I'm a runner. They're two inextricably intertwined things. I think all runners are scientists to some extent, and are drawn to that appeal of those, you know, experiments that they conduct on themselves, whether it's consciously or subconsciously. And again, this gets back to that idea of this is disrupting those experiments in an uncomfortable way. But speaking more broadly, that idea of, you know, to what extent do we want that to be a feat of engineering? Some people are excited and invigorated by that now confounding variable that we've added. And I, you know, I can't speak for them. And I'm not going to make the claim that I feel the way that everybody feels, because I know, like I said, it exists on a spectrum. My suspicion is, and this, you know, this gets back to actually, this is why we didn't get into this, to my thoughts on the Alpha Fly, but I'll give you my thoughts on the Alpha Fly when I saw it come out. I was really happy about it. I'm really happy that shoe was released, because I think it forces the issue on the sport now in a way that the previous regulation danced around it. So the regulation as I thought it was a week ago, that put a pause on everything and capped the shoes at what it was. And it kind of created this uncomfortable stasis that, again, this was something Alex Hutchinson mentioned in his piece. It was like this compromise. And that was kind of what we called for in the BJSM piece, was a compromise. It was almost like it left everybody a little unhappy. And it kind of left this large space of equipment still in the room. And, you know, okayed it on all sides. The Alpha Fly pushes the issue on the athletes and on the fans and makes it absolutely obvious you know, the effect that it will have and the role that it's playing. And I think it'll force the sport and the fans to make a more concrete decision. And my suspicion is it'll cause the entire ecosystem of the sport, not just, you know, the athletes in themselves self-regulating or the technology self-regulating within athletes of reaching a stasis, but I think it'll cause the broader ecosystem of the athletes and the fans to give it the thumbs up or thumbs down. And my disposition of not liking that level of performance enhancement coming from equipment, my suspicion is that the majority of fans feel the same way. And what that regulation will look like will be fans kicking back on it, losing interest in the sport, journalists writing about this, qualifying all performances, talking about the technology. My suspicion is it will dilute it, and it will, it'll bring it into painful relief, these feelings that we have of like, I don't know what I'm seeing here. This is not interesting anymore. This is not the distillation of human performance. And so I think the shoes will force the issue and really, really cause us, cause the, you know, those sides to come out and World Athletics to acknowledge it.
Yeah, I was equally happy because I think the Alpha Fly showed up the ludicrousness of the situation and revealed the rules for what they were, which was nothing.
Jeff Burns, thank you very much for your time. It's been absolutely wonderful having you on. It's such passion that you talk about the subjects, and I know it comes from that scientific passion, also from the running passion. So thank you very much for your, and you can follow Jeffrey on Twitter. He's Jeffrey Burns. It's not, there's no underscores or seven O's at the end of it. It's Jeffrey Burns, and you can follow his thinking on this very topical subject. Last word from you, Ross. Where does the future, what's the future looking like in the next year post-Olympics for this controversy?
I think it looks like 2019 because I think everything's just shifted one notch to the right because they've enabled Nike to continue to do what they were doing. They were ahead. They've enforced or ensured that other companies will have to respond. So I think everyone just moves 1 degree or 1%, let's call it, faster. But the have versus have nots thing doesn't go away. And I think it's ultimately quite sad. And I mean, Jeff alluded to this. The fundamental problem is that we can't evaluate what we see. So when Kipchoge breaks a world record, when Bekele scares the world record to within 2 seconds, when the Olympic title is won this year, when the London Marathon record is broken, the world record will fall again in the next 12 to 18 months, maybe two or three times because of shoes. We will not be able to properly evaluate what it is. And I think that that's actually quite sad because yeah. It was one of the fundamental things that we loved about running is evaluating what we saw, evaluating ourselves. And I think Jeff put it really well is, to what extent does that clock reflect a human achievement as opposed to an engineering breakthrough? And right now, we don't know the answer. And that's a real real pity, and it's not going away.
Don't forget, you can interact with us on Twitter at SportsSciPod. And, of course, with Professor Ross Tucker and Jeffrey Burns, as we've just spoken about. Let us know what you think about a podcast about this controversy. We'll be watching it and probably updating a number of podcasts in the next few months around the subject. It's a big one. It's going to be a lot of debate still to come. And we hope it's resolved to the satisfaction of everybody, if it ever is. Thanks so much, Ross and Jeff, for joining us. And we'll speak to you next time.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at SportsSciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.